As you're talking, I'm thinking you said to everybody here that maybe contract negotiations absolutely have to have AI on the table. But I think if we're armed, say if we have, and I forget how to pronounce her name, the sister that was fired from Google,
Me.
if we have her, if we have her knowledge of her company, if we know what she was writing about, right? Part of the negotiations would be we don't use Google, but we use these ethical AI tools, if you may. That's the type of things that I'm thinking about in the reimagining. Again, maybe instead of having the head of Google come to our journalism school, right? Which, in my opinion, has changed writing because everybody starts writing to the Google words versus just writing what they want to. Maybe we come to a company that you know that says, look, our journalism school is going to use this type of model. Why? Because it allows people not to emphasize going viral, but it allows us to maybe just tell the truth. You know, maybe a project is to start building our own search engines. You know, that type of thing. These are the things that I think are still possible, but I don't think they're fully realized because folks are still looking and saying, I want to be in the big leagues. And they see the big leagues as Google, Apple, you know, and those companies versus saying, well, the big leagues has always been what we create and people coming to see us. Again, when early on, when Public Enemy and all of us were down in Silicon Valley, they came to us, not the other way around. You see what I'm saying? They saw Harry Allen speaking at the New Music Seminar, talking about the information highway, and then Chuck putting it on an album, right? They were like, we need you to all to come down here. They were bringing Herbie Hancock and all of us. They were coming into the door through culture, right? That was the attraction, and then using culture as a validating tool. And many of those folks that I saw early on were immersed in our culture, and then there was a separation, like, culture's here and y'all are there. So you can have some of these genius minds in Silicon Valley and 30 miles away. You have all these artists that they listen to, but what's been the interaction? That chasm, I think, was very intentionally created. And so I think the value is in what we think of. And so I guess if you had your magic wand, what would be some of the things that you would say? For professors that are here in the school, for workers that we're talking to today, what would you ask them to do with AI now that they have this orientation?
Well, I'll tell you, I think of, the power we have here locally in the UC, where we're the premier research university of the United States as a system. We are close and tightly embedded with the CSU and the California Community Colleges. You could argue we have the most powerful educational system in the world here in California. We also, back in those days that you're talking about, we ran our computing locally, we networked locally. We did not outsource everything to Silicon Valley. Our students then learned how to do all, they built software that we used and our professors built and used. We built our computers. I mean, there were a lot of things that we did in the 90s that we don't do anymore. We ran our own IT backbones. And these things are really in our own security. Like all these things are very, very important. And I think that we should be reaching for some of the best practices of the past rather than, again, just being the bank to bankroll a lot of other people's projects that don't necessarily leave our students and our community more powerfully set up intellectually and as critical thinkers and as creators, quite frankly, right? It leaves them vulnerable to, I mean, we see right now the demise of computer science. Can you believe that? Because a large language model means you don't need to program anymore. And that actually robs our students because if they don't understand the logics that undergird the computing, then they are fully dependent and they can't actually be as creative, I believe. And this goes across, same with journalism. If you're just writing to the algorithm that's going to make your story go viral, you end up not knowing what you're losing in terms of investigative journalism, right? Or truth telling or protecting the public. We have a lot of resource and power, and we are also bombarded by salespeople selling their wares. And I think we should be more organized here locally and modeling locally what we can do. And by locally, I mean here in California. And that's something that will extend, in fact, as models for other parts of the world. So we have a lot, and there are people, but there hasn't, I will just tell you, I don't know, I'm like 14 years in to the UC, and I will say 12, 14, there isn't a big will. I mean, I have tried very hard. And so anyone on this call, I have colleagues that are on this call who know too. I know them, even banding together, we deal with the power system, of our universities, of our campuses. So, an amazing outcome, I believe, of like even this conversation could be that we gather to start thinking about how to operationalize and do these things. They're not, I actually believe that these are also profitable endeavors for the institution, and at its most crass base level of what it needs to do as a business to keep going, especially in this moment of austerity of losing all the federal funding. I will tell you, I train hundreds of students a year in at the intersection of technology and society, and they love, love, love. They want to know more. They want to go, they don't just want to go work at Google or Facebook. They want to think about public interest kinds of projects. They want to go work in community media. They want to figure out and they want to build different kinds of things. They want a different
Right.
kind of world. They have incredible imagination. It's
Well,
incumbent
that's,
on us to give them a pathway to it.
and I think that reimagining is what I'm talking about. Imagine setting up your Google, if you will, right here at UC Berkeley. But there's something that you said, and I wonder if this was a changing of the guard, so to speak. I don't know if it always existed when I went to Cal. First of all, I remember having to take those punch cards and go and, do my computer work right here on the campus. So that's how far back, right? But it was something about having to code that and get it right. Because if you didn't, then you had to go all the way back and rewrite all those punch cards and go do it again. But it grounded you and made you fundamentally sound, made you really have to be on point versus like I can chat GPT it like 100 times and never have to, put in that sweat equity. But universities had a change where they started owning anything that you created on this campus. I think Stanford was one of those places that you kind of heard people like, I created a play, but Stanford owns the play. And I don't know if that applies to the UC, but ownership of something that you create in these institutions, does that change the dynamic? And if so, is that something that needs to start to be negotiated so that maybe Jill or Jane can actually build a computer using the resources? And if there's a bit of business model, it's one that makes sense for everybody. You see what I'm
Yeah,
saying?
I
Versus,
do.
well, we own the intellectual property because you used our Wi-Fi in our library. No, that's our tax-paying money, or that was our tuition that helped pay for that. And we should maybe change the way in which we do the business, per se. That's me thinking about reimagining, and I wonder if there was a changing of the guard when university started owning everything you created.
Yeah, I mean, I think in especially in like early computing, the tech transfer and IP was it was geared toward the benefit of the institution for sure. And this is what and also probably tied to why a number of people dropped out of college and just went to the Valley and did their own thing, independent. People also stole. Their work that they did in graduate school and just left and went and spun it up. I mean, probably the most famous of that is Marc Andreessen, right? Stealing Mosaic and going and spinning up Netscape at the University of Illinois, where I went to school. So, we have certainly, I think, come a long way in the UC. I'll say from my vantage point at UCLA, where I've been, on these kind of like tech transfer committees, kind of oversight committees. We are still very much oriented and pointed around tech transfer and IP toward medical schools and engineering schools. We have not provided the proper apparatus for humanists and social scientists and artists to understand the business of their creative works and how to commercialize or bring those things into existence. And I think there are actually a lot of people, a lot of faculty and students who have great ideas, but they cannot actually apprehend the apparatus of the university because it's so, this is everyday business. If you're a medical doctor, or, and you're making a new drug, or you're going to run a trial that's going to lead to something that's sold to pharma, but it's not the same if you are an artist and you have a new, and of course, we know that that's also where the majority of students of color are. They're in the social sciences and in the humanities, and they're doing these kind, they care deeply about the world and they care about culture, and they don't have an apparatus for commercialization. And I do think that's very important for us to have as a pathway. And that's a huge opportunity that we're missing.
Do you think that's intentional or by design? I think it's by design because that creative aspect, that humanist, if you will, is often pimped. I often yet like to use the ideology, the example of watching graffiti artists, right? I would see graff artists being in hip hop do these incredible layups on the side of a train. And then a couple of years later, as those artists are criminalized and demonized, there's some ad exec that comes along and goes, I'm going to take that idea and wrap a movie title around the bus and call it a wrap and be, the ad exec of the year. I would see people put a tag up on a building, right? Because they figured out the most people would watch the top of this building and see they get criminalized and demonized. And some ad exec does the same exact thing. And of course, is seen as being, forward thinking. And so a lot of these folks in these other disciplines, they're the ones that are being trained on these machines about, how are they programming music on Spotify? What's their listening habits on YouTube or viewing habits, et cetera, et cetera. And those companies basically, kind of take their habits, train their machines, make us a consumer while they make billions and don't reinvest. And so, again, I think it's something that, first of all, part of the training that we need to teach our kids is that what they're thinking of, their imagination has value. And
Absolutely.
they should know what it's worth versus just freely giving it away. One question, another question I want to ask you, and this also comes from somebody in the chat about if you're using AI too much, there's this atrophy in your brain. And I think there was a study, I'm not sure if it was MIT or some other school that talked about people who just relied upon chat weren't able to really think. Again, going back to reimagination. Maybe we need to be designing things, or at least I try to, so you do have to think. So if you do use the tool, your brain is still working, but your thoughts on just that atrophy thing that
Yeah.
is that the studies had shown.
Yeah, we definitely know that ChatGPT is diminishing people's cognitive ability. This research is coming out. We know that it also, for people who work in the creative industries, it really diminishes their creativity. It takes the soul and spirit, quite frankly, literally out. I mean, you can tell work or screenplays, anything that's written by AI, and it has no soul. And you can't really. A soul is, I guess that's a conversation for another day, but I'm going to say the soul cannot be programmed. Just as a general statement about how I see it. So, for sure. And of course, the social media and just our brain rot, right? I mean, we literally have like cultural ways of talking about people laying in bed all day, rotting, brain rotting from scrolling social media all day. So, we know, of course. That that's happening. If you look in some of the darker corners where I look, you can look at things like AI chatbots that are used for therapy and companionship that are really powerfully destroying and negatively impacting the mental health of people who use them. People who are falling in love with chatbots and people who do self-harm at the recommendation of or in relationship with these. I think about this all the time. What does it mean to socialize and normalize students' use of chatbots, given that we know there's so many of these harmful mental health kinds of and cognitive consequences? Blood on our hands. I mean, we really actually have to be accountable. We cannot think of things as just like tool because that depoliticizes and depersonalizes what is actually happening with them. So what does it mean then to, and I think if you're in math, and I've heard like people who've won the highest prizes in math in the world, who profoundly believe in the use of things like large language models because they just like cut off so much busy work for the math student, right? Well, that's something when you have a deep set of classifiers that everybody is universally kind of agreed upon in a field and they don't change, right? But when you apply those things to the social world, which is deeply subjective and not agreed upon, and you know, then they're actually something completely different. So part of this is disciplinarily, we misunderstand what these things are based on how we use them if you're in, you know, math or chemistry versus you're in sociology or African American studies or gender studies. So I think these things are very, very, very important. And this is why we have to keep having these conversations and we have to look deeply and we can't just buy into the hype cycle
Right.
where the cost is high, I believe, right now. And we will see this in a generation. We already have Gen Zs in our classroom right now who tell me, you know, openly, they don't know what to think. They have already been through 12 years of socializing in K through 12, that's study to the test, pass the test, you know, get the grades you need to get into Berkeley or UCLA or any, you know, of these kinds of universities where they learn to the rubric and they have lost their capacity to know what they think about a thing. And when you ask them, like, write me an essay on what you think about this, they're frozen. So
Right.
imagine what that will be like with 12 years of kids using ChatGPT. Where will the thinking, how will we learn how to think? These things are fundamentally rewiring our hardware, our neurosystem. I mean, that's just
Well,
a fact.
I call it addiction, and I also say it's a continuum, as I said earlier, of getting people to be a consummate consumer. If I go back to my days at Clear Channel and Time Warner, one of the things I'll never forget, working right over here at KML, our boss coming in 1994, 95, and said, "For now on, we're going to make this station a bad habit that people can't quit. Even if you don't listen to the station, you're going to know that it's the station for hip hop and R&B." And they would do all these studies on how to figure it out, breaking it down to demographics, like what do Latino women think, what do Black women think, what do white guys think, all these different things to figure out what buttons emotionally to push so that people would be locked in. Years later, working in programming at Time Warner, Dick Parsons, may rest in peace, it's like we're going to reinforce learned behavior. And so that became a thing too of getting people locked in. And these were, 15 years ago. So now the question is, what sort of things are being put forth that people are literally addicted? Like you
Yeah.
can't get out of bed, you're just scrolling endlessly. And so, from your standpoint and the people that you work with, is there an antidote to break that addiction? Is there something that we can start doing to move people in another direction?
Sure. I mean, well, let me just say that I was one of the people ensnared in the KML trap, because I was a hardcore KML and KBLX listener when I lived in Oakland, where I listened to you also on the radio. And certainly the models that undergirded legacy media like radio and television for sure was about behavioral modification and getting people pointed toward advertisers
And
and
we would
products.
study that.
Of
We would
course.
put people in a room on a campus like this and
Yes.
study down to what color do you respond to? And that would be the color of the bumper sticker.
Absolutely. No
What
pressure.
songs do you listen to? And they would do all these tech models then, turn it up if you like it, turn it up. And that would determine what DJs were on air, all that sort of stuff. And this is in the 90s. But the goal was to make you, as my boss said at the time, "We want you to be a habit that you can't quit." I can't believe that Google, Apple, and all these Silicon Valley giants have not, enhanced that model of
Sure.
having us addicted.
Not only have they enhanced, but listen, the difference with legacy media is that you were aggregating me into a group of like-minded people. So you're like, oh, okay, well, these people, if they are college graduates, they are generally like this as a group. Black women generally like this as a group, right? But you were targeting groups, not individuals. And that was actually the very big difference with tech, with the kind of surveillance tech that we live under and work in now. You can do that level of aggregation at such a specific level that you truly can have people in completely different social media experiences, media experiences. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why it's been so dangerous to have social media displace newspapers or newsrooms or other kinds of community radio, these public radio, these kinds of legacy media that are very, very important as like a shared truth, shared knowledge space. If you are in your own unique social media feed, right, or search feed, then which is still aggregated. Don't get me wrong. But now those things have been, it's much easier to do things like right-wing radicalize people when they have these kinds of more customized media experiences that are driven by tech platforms. Remembering that tech companies are actually different than journalism professionals, which have like a code of ethics and like standards. And even though that there's a lot of slippage
There
there.
ain't no code of ethics no more.
Maybe not, but that there's no code of ethics in software engineering. Okay. So these things matter in terms of what is it that we are experiencing. And there's no question that the kinds of engagements we have technically are socializing us into more and more kind of behavior modification. Of course, this is when I say like that we have alternatives. Could we have social media that isn't just about driving us to buy products? Sure, we could. No question. Could we design social media platforms where it's not a race to the bottom in the worst kinds of antisocial behavior with each other? Certainly, we could.
Well,
We actually
those things
see
are
an impulse
there.
right now where people are trying to make these smaller, localized kinds of social media experiences, right?
But the addiction is so deep that even though I have these other platforms, I'm still addicted to the popular ones right now. I want to ask you another question. This comes from the chat about job replacement. What's the impact that AI has on that? And maybe let me kind of give a additional context. I don't need to hire an engineer or an editor or anybody to make my film or to make my records. That's my wife is like, why don't you get a real singer? Because I could do it right now. I don't need to hire all that. I can be a one man or one woman show using the tools, but at what expense, right? And if we scale it up, well, why do we need four employees when we can just do one, right? Why do we need 10 professors when we can just do two, right? Those types of things happen. And if you're the beneficiary of it, that's great. But at the same time, jobs are being eliminated. And you have folks that may say, well, either you scale up or you die, learn to adapt or tough boogies. How do we kind of deal with that sort of reality, especially if we're talking about AI? Does it, the adapt or die model apply in this sense?
Yeah. Well, I think, there's definitely creatives held up as the primary example of the threats of AI. I think what we're actually seeing in reality is that, let's say in customer service facing jobs where you're interfacing with the public, which is different than, let's say, making art, people want to talk to other people that are highly knowledgeable and have high customer service skills. People really don't want to do all their business with bots. We already see this, right? So those will be choices that people will make. I actually think if you look broadly, you'll see that the premium right now, the premium luxury brands and experiences in the world are non-AI, non-technical, high-touch, human-to-human kind, if that's in education, that's in fine dining, in brand experiences, like this kind of, I think you'll see more and more bifurcation of AI-driven kinds of experiences in businesses will be lower quality, mass kinds of projects. And we already see this, and we've seen the research, right, on the ways in which more of this kind of bot-driven type of work is low quality work. And it's really designed to replace workers, and those will be low wage workers. I think you will also have people, again, white collar jobs already that are reporting out that chatbots make work more work for them. In some cases, up to 77% more work because they have to check the work of the chatbot that is not reliable. So the question will be, what will fundamentally change if you like? Why would anyone go? I mean, I have been asked this question since I've been writing about Google for, I've been asking for 15 years, my students, well, why go to UCLA if you can just Google your way through life? You got a search engine. What do you need to go to college for? And they're like, Dr. Noble, you know, because they understand there is actually something happening by going to a university and sitting in a classroom and being with people and debating and doing Socratic kinds of learning that is actually not the same as asking a chatbot or a search engine. So I think, you know, I don't think there's a threat to those kinds of endeavors. I don't think professors can be replaced by chatbots. I think that actually is just something different. Fundamentally different than being in a classroom space with others and learning. That doesn't mean that there won't be industries, though, that will adopt these technologies where there will be threats. And this is again why, you know, SAG-AFTRA, the Writers Guild, the Directors Guild are bargaining over the use of AI, because in some kinds of professions, it actually does matter that you replace artists with technology. And let me just also say that the art that is produced and the kinds of things that are produced by AI actually are different than the kinds of things that humans create and experience.
In
And so
what
that's
way?
worth thinking about. Well, you know, I remember talking to, and this is anecdotal, this is not based on a study, all right? But I will say, we know that the ones and zeros of digital music actually hit the brain differently than the way vinyl and the way the ear and the brain hear and process music from vinyl or live music. The frequency of ones and zeros is different than the frequency of the bass sitting in the room. Okay. So that's different. It's actually something different than live music. And when we think about like the impact that music has on the body positively, right? That's not the same thing as ones and zeros music touching the body. So if you really want to get nerdy about it,
But the ones and zeros have been around long before AI. You know, the digitizing of music has been
sure.
around for a long
That's what I
time.
mean.
But I think, you know,
But digital
I think
music
that
is not the same thing as live music.
no, it isn't. But that's an age-old debate that we've had within hip hop and the whole nine, you know, with the musicians were coming along and say, you're ruining the music and people don't feel the soul. And it's like, now you hear this new song that we did, you're feeling the soul. And, you know, I went to Wu-Tang the other night. You felt the soul
Good.
with all their
And
digitized
Tuba
music.
Player was on the stage, and Questlove was on the drums. I was there at the Hollywood Bowl with the Roots Picnic.
No,
You
I'm
know,
talking
I
about
mean,
over here. Yeah,
yeah, but you know what
but
I'm saying is that
yeah.
I'm not saying it's better or worse, but I am saying it's something different. And you know, I'm not putting a moral judgment on it, but I am saying that saying that we're going to replace professors and teachers with chatbots means we're making something fundamentally different, is what
But
I'm
see,
saying.
this comes down to, and I have another question that I'll tie this into. This comes down to what is a power player like this university that we're sitting in? What do they do at the end of the day? Somebody's making a decision to, you know, dwindle down the use of professors and replace it with this. And the question becomes, why and who is making that decision? Is it a deal that they made with some of the tech companies who have a product that they're trying to sell? Is it somebody who has an ideology that they're trying to push? Are people aware of that, and are they fighting back in creating a demand to say, no, we need to make sure that things move in a very different direction? And those are choices that three different entities
Yeah,
make. There's an
professors are
administration
more
that makes it,
effective.
there's a business that makes it, and then
Sure.
there's the potential folks, students and staff that make. Kind of tied into
Listen,
this. Yeah.
JB, but listen, yes, there are people for whom chatbots are cheaper than the labor of professors and
Right.
secretaries and people who clean up our classrooms, and the cost of labor. In any endeavor is actually what is always up against these kinds of new innovations, right? Is reducing the cost of the labor force. But that is also reducing the opportunity for people to take care of their families, have creative expression through their work, all of the things that we know,
Well,
right? So,
that comes to ethics then, right? At the end of the
okay.
day.
I will just say
And
that.
I would say some of these same people who would want to cut costs would not want to cut costs when they're, say, traveling on a plane. They want first class seats and they want premier treatment. They're not going to cut costs on the car that they drive, right? They want the premier car. So why are they going to cheapen the experience of folks who are experiencing the product, in this case, education? And I think, again, that's a mindset thing where somebody is conditioned to say, well, we can cut costs when you're learning, but we're not going to cut costs when I'm traveling. They're not going to sit in the economy seat or take a cheap flight. They want all the bells and whistles. And I think all of us should be demanding the bells and whistles and the quality at all levels. And I think we're being conditioned to be like, well, you know what? It's okay if I just have a chat box when I call the bank or when I call up, a place where I need service. And that becomes a thing that we have to get out of that habit. That's the addiction I was talking about. We're so used to it that we haven't moved on. Somebody had a question about environment, and it comes down again, choices. What can individuals do to lessen maybe their footprint, or to, contribute to maybe not harming the environment?
Yeah. Well, I think that there are, in the university, fortunately, we still have, these ideas around shared governance, and we have, some semblance of democratic participation in decision making. And there are a lot of competing ideas. Certainly, the tech adoption in the university, context is not cheap. It's actually very expensive. So we should be mindful about that. The underwriting of a lot of technology in universities is often by the subsidizing from things like federal grants, and those things are going away at this moment. So we have a lot of in kind of in this moment of collapse, we have a lot of opportunity to dream and imagine differently. And I'm very excited about trying to stay in that positive space right now. I think there are choices that get made at the level of like a unit or a department. People, especially staff people, have an incredible amount of decision-making capacity, even more so in some ways around the, let's say, the institutional drivers of like how we do work. And that's important. I mean, there's no one on this call who has not suffered many a body blow, I'm sure, from a new technical system that we have called UCPath. And I'm going to just give a moment of silence for what we hope will be the one day death of UCPath. So, it is a technical system that billions of dollars has gone into that has radically shifted the way we do business, not for the positive for many people who experience it, right? So, again, this is about not just about money, it's about prioritizing things like centralized IT and technical systems like a UCPath, where now at the local level, we can't even write a check to solve a problem, right? Like somebody's financial aid gets messed up in the system. Used to, the financial aid office would be like, come back in the afternoon, baby, and we got a check for you so you can pay your rent and you can eat. But with that, those days are over because now we have centralized IT in UCPath. So we lost a lot in terms of what we could do to solve problems and to like make things go and to also have community and like really make it work. And that's because the system was sold at the highest levels of the administration. So we have to you put our voices out. I mean, when we lose people, staff people who have 30, 40 years of institutional knowledge about how things work, we lose a lot. And if we think an IT system is going to replace them, it's not.
Right.
So this is where we, I think, have to just be smarter and have voice and put that voice together collectively in our staff associations and our faculty senates. You know, we've got to surface the kind of, again, ways in which we want to work. And those are really important individual choices that you get to make. We're in the middle of a massive struggle right now over something called Trellix, which is a cybersecurity, alleged cybersecurity software that the UC wants every single person to put on their machines. And what that does is, from the view of many faculty, myself included, is it is spyware that looks into our computers and doesn't protect our research subjects and our students who are protected by FERPA and our subjects who are, you know, our research partners who are subject to protections through institutional review, IRB. This is very, very like damaging and dangerous, okay? And yet it's like in the name of cybersecurity, you know, we're going to be locked out of like IT systems and campus Wi-Fi and all these things if we don't adopt it. So these are struggles that are actively happening right now that people need to know about and need to get involved in. And you know, these are not just like I'm helpless because I have to, you know, you actually have a lot of knowledge about your
Right.
job and about stakes,
Well,
and you've got
I
to
think
put that with others.
people have been gaslit to think that if you hear a system like Trollocs or Palantir or anything like that, it's that you can't do anything. That somehow this is like God coming down on earth and you're just helpless. And again, it's coming back to refurbishing our imagination, refurbishing the fact that, as I was always taught, you are smarter than the problems that are put in front of you. You can outthink them. You have to be able to outthink them. And I think you have to triple down on that thought, you know, as we move forward, especially if they want to have a 10-year scenario where there's no regulation. You know, that can seem daunting, or it can be, you know what? I know you, and you know Craig Watkins, and you know so and so, and you know so and so. So we're a superior brain trust than those folks, which leads me to another question. For the staff that's here right now, they're getting this orientation, and they're hearing some things they haven't heard before. What are three best practices that you would say for the general staff here to start really putting into place, or at least start demanding as we move forward?
Okay, I think the first thing is every staff unit that can bargain should be bargaining around the use of different kinds of technologies in their job because you have a lot of power as unionized workers. The faculty are not unionized in the UC, so we do not have the same kind of ability to be as effective in terms of contracts. Our labor contracts. So I think that's a really, really powerful mechanism that you have. And there are a lot of resources and people in the UC who can just help people think. I think that sharing information, setting up committees, and you know within your organizations and information sharing is and organizing around it is very important. And that's a practical thing that you can do. The stories from the front lines of the things I have heard, I talked to a lot of like business services staff who, you know, people may not think of them as intellectual drivers because they're not professors, but let me tell you how much they know about how to make the business of the university happen for students and for other staff and for faculty. Like they are so important and they know a lot of things about what works and what doesn't work. And then, you know, and HR people, you know, and food service workers, I mean, you would not believe the number of people that have deep knowledge. And I think that's really important because we need to understand what is being lost with each new kind of like impulse for us to uptake. We need to also study the distribution of the budgets on our campuses and understand like what is like ripe for the taking by companies that come in from outside the campus and say like pay us $1 billion to do X. That $1 billion might be better suited to pay people who have jobs to do that work and also build skills and build knowledge and keep that capacity. And of course, the most important thing is we are in a massive onslaught and threat to education, K through higher ed in this country. There is no question about it that there is a full-scale Project 2025 assault on education and on intellectuals, on conversations like this, Davey, the people would just like to make illegal these kinds of conversations. So the threats to free speech and to education and to critical thinking are very real. Everybody has a stake in that. If you work in a university, you can't vote against the interests of the very kinds of place that you work in. It's really, really important. These next set of elections that are coming up, if you don't believe in politics, well, politics are affecting that just at UCLA alone, we're facing a $1 billion shortfall that's going to have a horrible impact on our community and especially on our staff and our students. And so everybody's got to understand that these dots are connected and we're connected to each other.
So that's the larger fight. But I'm sitting in front of an AI tool right now, some form of fashion. What are the best practices that one should be doing? Like, I have a set of practices that I would recommend for my students, for example, as a professor. So if you're going to use AI, here's some things that you should do, right? First thing, just don't think that you're going to have a creative essay from scratch come up, right? And I have some guardrails and things that kind of reinforce that. So you're not going to be able to get away with that. I may say that, that you're going to have to come in and we're going to have an oral exam or talk to you about what you're doing. I'm just giving like some things to think about. So you got these AI tools. What are the things? I may say that, I need everybody to interact with one another face to face. Right, have these conversations. We're just going to spend a day just talking and building and establishing relationships, things like that that technology has made us lose. Like, I'm going to be very intentional. I'm going to call you instead of texting you. That might be a best practice. So from your standpoint, in a technological world, with somebody who's now looking at AI tools that are practicing surveillance on them, what are some best practices we can do with that?
So I'll give you some things that I do with my students in the classroom. I have a favorite exercise where I have my students go off the grid for 48 hours. What do you have to do to go off the grid? Well, you got to figure out how you're going to get in and out of your dorm. You're going to have some cash and buy food in cash. You're going to have to make plans and actually be there. Because you're not going to text. You better know where you're going because you're not going to have GPS. You got to download and print all your readings because you're not going to be opening up the Canvas or the learning management system. It's more so an exercise in critical thinking and like how hard it is to not participate and have choice about when and where to participate. And it really blows their mind. And they love this exercise. Some of them sleep the whole weekend because it's just too hard. And others really enjoy that they had to figure out how to live. And I remind them, look, we just had the fires in LA, the Eaton fire, and people were without power. So guess what? You're not going to have an AI tool if you don't have power. You're going to have to figure out some of those things. Another thing that I, as a best practice, is having access to some type of centralized shared communication, and not and like we had thousands of students at UCLA who were not signed up for Bruin alerts and didn't even understand what the campus was communicating in an emergency, and it never occurred to them that there would be shared communication. Because none of them watch the news. None of them watch like cable news. They all get their me news from social media, which means they think that news and information should be customized and personalized. It doesn't even occur to them that there's shared information we all need to have to act upon. So getting that as a, that's a big loss that we've had between Gen X to Gen Z is that breakdown. And then, I mean, I have actually encouraged my students to not use AI in the classroom because they have become really good at like transcribing every single word that comes out of the speaker in the front of their room. Like they can transcribe anything, but they can't actually sit with the computer closed and the devices closed and give their full attention for 70 minutes to a
Right.
lecture. Like they can't do it. It really kills them. And that's something they're losing. And, I'm
But
like,
that's a 12-year-old habit. And
yeah, so it's fun
it
to
goes
write
beyond,
that up.
but it goes beyond AI because that started when we were teaching towards the test, right? No Child Left Behind and all that, which comes back to, to me, maybe a best practice is not to teach to the test.
Oh,
What does
sure.
it look like in a technological world when we change the type of test that we give? Is it a right or wrong answer, or is it something, or is it an execution of a particular task? These are the types of things that are going through my mind now, and I think it's people like yourselves and others that need to sit in a room with folks like myself and other professors and be like, okay, what do we as Voltron coming together come up with that's going to be amenable for the current climate that we're in, knowing that people have a habit, knowing that they need to break a habit, knowing that they may have to have a new set of thinking tools to add to their, repertoire of stuff, figuring out ways in which we can, in a very, non-painful way, get people unaddicted to tech, unaddicted to their phones. Those are the things that are going through my head. I don't know if there's an immediate answer, but I think that's something to really start thinking about right now. I think the key to whatever type of domination folks want to have on, using tech against the masses is to keep us addicted. So you literally will have people locked in on their phones, as you said, while a fire is going on in LA and not realizing it's happening. Locked in if, their phones and not realizing that we bombed another country because the algorithm didn't show all that sort of stuff for them. And so that's where I find the danger. If people are really woke, this thing about being woke, but I mean woke and not locked into somebody's technosphere, if you can, might be a start to freeing us and moving us in another direction.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think everywhere that we can, it's not the everyday things where people really deeply learn. It's the rub, the like I hadn't thought about that before, where like synapses can really get fired up. And what I'm always interested in with my students, obviously, because I'm a social scientist, I don't really teach the test because I'm trying to teach people how to think and how to think critically. And that is a bit more of a subjective kind of educational. We use different kinds of methods versus there is a right or wrong answer. But I will tell you that I see more and more students struggling to not know how to think. And everywhere that we are introducing AI to like, shortcut the steps involved in thinking. I think Professor DeKosnick put a great study in the chat about the loss of critical thinking and the research on this. And I think that is actually, again, it's really different in different contexts because if we study a technology like Photoshop in your class, right, or with your work, and that's actually different than the way we might talk about Photoshop in a gender studies course that I could teach, where we talk about what Photoshop has done to completely transform the way women understand themselves, their bodies, and their value in a society that commodifies a particular type of beauty standard. And, and that Photoshop is deeply implicated in that over generations now. So much so to the point that girls want to have plastic surgery to look like how they look with a Snapchat filter, right? So that's a social consequence of a technology that, in the context of an art and design class, would never be necessarily interrogated that way. So this is why this kind of context shifting work is so important in the university, that we think about AI. Again, what my math and computer science colleagues would say in the way that they might use AI is very different than the way someone in environmental and climate might think about the implications of it. And the point of a university is for you to enter and have an opportunity to touch as many dimensions of thinking about ideas and experiences and social phenomena and tools and all kinds of things, so that you leave 4 or 5 years later thinking in complex ways. And that's really the invitation here. I'm not saying that I have all the answers. I have one slice in on this conversation. I think it's an important slice, but it lives in dialogue with other disciplines and other ways of knowing too.
Real talk. We're going to wrap up, and we appreciate you, Dr. Noble, for joining us. I would say just my final thought is that the fault line is whether or not you're going to be allowed to think. And whether or not you even know that you're thinking versus just being programmed to be a consumer. That's where we're at. And I think those who have resources need to wrestle with that. And those of us who know need to wrestle them to make sure that we encourage thinking and imagination and not get people to be a consumer, even though it can be very profitable, but to get them to really start, wrestling with these ideas, which is what ideally these spaces were supposed to be about, really wrestling with the complexities, as you said earlier, of all these things. And with that being said, leave people with m maybe some marching orders or a couple of books, including yours, that folks should read to really go deeper into this so that they can be armed with information when it comes time to dealing with some of these systems that are in front of them.
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, I think that Algorithms of Oppression is a great kind of like entry point in a very easy to read and understand way of like the politics of technology and like what the stakes are for different people, especially for people who are traditionally marginalized and oppressed in our society. You know, like just get your talking points. And you know, I would also say let your guard down about thinking about AI as purely just a tool, the dog, and consider that it is more than a tool, and that flattening and reducing it and thinking of it only in that way actually obfuscates a lot of other important things that we need to think about. Like, what does it mean that the people who are behind things like OpenAI are also openly interested in like eugenics and other kinds of philosophies, right, that are very, very important that we should be thinking about. Watch and see what's happening in San Francisco as, you know, tech billionaires are interested in like turning a city like San Francisco into, you know, a technical state that they can then, you know, exercise a variety of different
And
kinds of
very angry
frightening
that they
ideas.
could and very angry that they couldn't win Oakland because they
Yes.
wanted to have the trifecta, San Jose, Oakland and San Francisco, because that was to be the experimental thing. So to your point, watch how they turn up to try and, capture Oakland so they can have those three large cities to do this work. That's a
Yes.
very good point.
You know, these things are not just tools. They're also about ideologies, about how society and communities should work, who gets to live and where affordable housing can be, who gets jobs, who doesn't. These things are connected. And, you know, when you catch yourself saying like, oh, it's just a tool, oh, it's just a that, like, go like, but wait, maybe I should think more deeply. And Karen Howes, I can't recommend her new book enough, Empire of AI. It's a bestseller, just came out. She's an incredible investigative journalist, and she's written a really interesting book that'll take you forward.
Dr. Sophia Noble, thank you so much.
You're
I think we're
amazing.
going to wrap it up. Thank you to everybody who came and hung out with us this afternoon. And Katrina, we're going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Just a round of applause and love and kudos to both Dr. Noble and David D for an incredible conversation. Time went by really fast. I just have a couple of things I want to share here. First off, thank you to everyone in the audience who engaged in this afternoon, who took advantage of this opportunity for your own growth, for your own learning. And I just want to share that oftentimes after kind of these big, events, right, you have something like a keynote, where you get a refreshed perspective, maybe more energy, interest, motivation around a particular, subject, right? Oftentimes we also get more curious, and there's this sort of thought of like, where it's not quite clear, well, what now, right? What do I do next? And so what we like to do following every Critical Voices program is to offer what we believe here, in People and Culture's Office for Staff Engagement and Belonging, what our response is, right, to that question of, what now, right? What's next? And so with that in the chat, I'm just going to share a link to a program that I encourage you all to participate in. That there will be information shared campus-wide through a Cal message and updated on the website containing a flyer as well. But to respond to that question of now what, we invite you all to apply to engage in this program. The Berkeley Cultural Awareness and Humility Training Series, or BCHATS, right, as that response. We're entering our fifth year of sponsoring this particular program, which we formerly called the Berkeley Equity Training Series. And what it is, for folks who aren't aware, is that it's a virtual intentional sequence of seven sessions throughout the fall semester, each facilitated by a subject matter expert who leads the workshop that's focused on a particular cultural community. And so this will be taking place again virtually on Fridays from 12 to 3 from September through December. Again, there will be more information provided campus-wide about this. And we say that this is kind of the response to that question of now what, because it's a container, it's a structure, it's a guided opportunity that's free, right? That's sort of low stakes in the sense that really you just showing up, engaging, connecting with your colleagues, right, in dialogue. That's really the work. And so it's an opportunity for you to, again, continue this learning journey and path. And so finally, I'll just say, following this webinar, please take the time to review an email from me containing a resource guide from today's program that'll contain some of the resources that were, mentioned earlier on, as well as a request to complete a survey to give your feedback about today's experience. Thank you all just so much for all that you do. Please take care of yourselves and have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Noble. Thank you, David D.
Very
Thank
thank
you,
you.
Liz. Appreciate y'all. Have a good one.
The sunshine cracking through the silence with a fire on my mind. Voices raised in rhythm, every step a sacred sign. We gonna rise above the fear, always backed by the divine. They're snatching families for no reason, locked in cages with no way out, stripped of work. Dignity drowned while the rich just laugh and count. The streets feel heavy and hope gets lost in anger and disarray. But even in the darkest hour, we will rise and win the day. Gonna rise and win the day, pushing pain and fear away. Ain't no way they're gonna keep us down. We rise like seeds through concrete ground.
Brighter days are coming. Brighter days are coming. coming. They locking judges, killing truth, trying to break what justice means. Humbling stars who shine too bright, afraid of young black kings and queens. But we ain't built to bow or beg. We break the chains, we flip the script. What they fear is in our blood, and we don't fold, we lead, we live. Gonna rise and win the day, pushing pain and fear away. Ain't no way they're gonna keep us down. We rise like seas through concrete ground.
Brighter days are coming. Brighter days are coming. Brighter days are coming.
We're gonna rise and win the day, pushing pain and fear away. Ain't no way they're gonna keep us down. We rise like seas through concrete ground.
Brighter days are coming.
Truth to the people everywhere we go.
Speaking truth to power, we let you know.
We're frontline struggles to the people who shine. We break it down with the culture in mind. Truth to the people everywhere we go.
Speaking truth to power, we let you know.
Seek it for the bow and let you know. Rocking on your radio, speaking steel everywhere we go. Hard knock rocking on your radio.
Black Revolution!